Coming up on Weekend America.
Are you willing to do what it takes to fully participate in government?
I've got a place where I'm going to give free food and drinks, and I've got a bus. I'm going to try to get as many of my supporters on a bus and take them to the vote so I know that they actually are going to show up.
In Ohio, citizens mount their own campaigns to become party delegates. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. When a person sends out an all-points bulletin to find a broken heart, who will answer the call?
I think friends are a better shoulder to cry on than random strangers that might see your sign, and I think that's the best possible scenario of the people that would call. Probably be a little creepier.
The hunt for the heartbroken. And later, do you have the urge to eat aphids and bring humans good luck?
I'm enjoying seeing these things that these animals do and thinking, ladybugs do the things that I feel compelled to do.
Observe weekend Americans in their natural habitat after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, Happy New Year. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This hour, we are reliving some of our favorite stories of 2007, and we'll give you an update. Whatever happened to that person anyway? Stay tuned for those stories this hour. So, how did you do with this year's New Year's resolutions? Did you keep those?
Yeah, I quit smoking 6 months ago.
The only thing I really do at the new year is just try and clean the slate.
Probably just like try new experiences. Like I went bridge jumping this summer, and you go to a really tall bridge somewhere over a body of water and then you just jump off into the water.
Maybe some intentions. Resolution seems like a lot of commitment to me right now.
Boy, I'm not even sure I made any resolutions this past year.
What are you going to do next year then?
Next year? Oh gosh. Maybe bungee jumping or skydiving? We'll see.
Wow, I was just going to resolve to eat fewer donuts.
So inadequate. Those voices came to us from New York, Seattle, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Anchorage, Alaska.
Well, presidential candidates are scrambling for votes ahead of the Iowa caucuses on Thursday, and the New Hampshire primaries just a week later. But they're not the only ones who are scrambling for votes. Ordinary citizens are also on the campaign trail. They're trying to become delegates to the national conventions this summer. Well, the process varies by state, but in the key battleground state of Ohio, people who want to be delegates have to line up behind a specific candidate by the first week in January. If their candidate loses the primary, then they don't get to be a delegate to the national convention. So that makes becoming a delegate both a strategic effort and a crapshoot. Weekend America's Mari Saito reports from WCPN in Cleveland.
Aaron Sullivan Lally's campaign headquarters to become an Ohio delegate for Hillary Clinton is the living room of her Cleveland home. As two of her five kids play upstairs, Lally picks up toys and stray socks hiding under sofas and outlines her strategy.
Free pizza and beer.
In Ohio, Democrats elect their slates of delegates at special gatherings nicknamed Delegate Night. That'll be on January 3rd. Lally plans to fill the house.
Well, I'm inviting family and friends. I'm mailing them postcards. I've got a place where I'm going to give free food and drinks, and I've got a bus. I'm going to try to get as many of my supporters on a bus and take them to the vote so I know that they actually are going to show up.
Lally admits she's taking her effort to an extreme. It helps that she's a former state legislator who now designs campaign literature. She figures she'll shell out several $100 to try and win enough votes to go to the Democratic National Convention next summer.
But you don't have to spend money to do this. Anybody who wants to run as a delegate needs only bring their family and friends and supporters to the vote, which is simple, a simple phone call. I'm taking it, you know, the next level up because I really want to do this. You know, I'm excited about, you know, the first woman president, which is, you know, part of history. I want to be a part of that history.
In the old days, the party convention was where the delegates would get together, debate issues in the platform, and elect the party's nominee for president. These days, that nomination is usually wrapped up months before the convention. Delegates have to pay their own way and listen to lots of speeches. I wondered what the big deal was. I went to see Deborah Burstyn Donbraye.
I wondered if you could explain sort of what does a delegate do? What does you do? You laugh.
Burstyn Donbraye went to the Republican National Convention in New York City 4 years ago. She spent about $3,000 to stand on the convention floor and have her view of the stage blocked by former Ohio Governor Bob Taft's head. but she loved it. Burchan Donbraye had been George W. Bush's press secretary back when he first ran for governor of Texas, and she wanted to represent him after she moved back to Ohio.
It is what you want it to be. It wasn't a ceremonial position for me. For me, it was personal, and it was a joy.
In Ohio, each Republican presidential candidate is working up a list of 88 delegates and 88 alternates. It's not an easy job because a lot of people are waiting to see which candidate pulls ahead. Ohio State Senator Kevin Coghlan is in charge of finding delegates for Republican candidate Mitt Romney.
Not too many people in Ohio have done a lot of deep thinking about this race. You know, the candidates are working Iowa and New Hampshire and the early primary states. They're raising money here in Ohio, but rather quietly. So, you know, your public officials and your party leaders have had the luxury of being able to sit back and not choose sides yet.
And it's not just officials waiting it out. If you really want to go to your party's convention, you have to put all your money on one horse. Retired United States Marine Corps Captain Philip DiBianca has been agonizing for weeks over his delegate application for the Democratic Party.
The idealist in me right now would like to see somebody like Joe Biden. But the pragmatist in me, if I want to get to the convention, the way things are going, I got the forms down there. The only thing blank is the line. I'll probably put Hillary Clinton.
The problem for DiBianca is that he's never been to a convention before. He's a newcomer to the local political scene, and he's 60.
If your guy wins the primary, then you go. If the other guy wins, so I'm trying to pick the candidate that's going to go. You know, like I say, time's short. If I was younger, I'd be more idealistic. I'd say I got 40 more shots at this. I only got two or three left.
Maybe DiBianca needs to worry less about filling out his application and much more about free pizza and beer. Erin Sullivan Lally is already lining up babysitters for her voters and finishing up her mailing.
Well, let's save the date. Thursday, January, I think it's 3rd. It says get a magnet, put this on your fridge.
In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Weekend America.
From 4 to 5:30 p.m., I have free pizza and beer at P.J. McIntyre.
Well, that's one end of the Democratic participation spectrum. But at the other end, of course, there's the unregistered, uninterested, non-voter.
Right. And what makes a voter interested? We're looking to our election coverage in 2008, and we'd like to hear from you if you are getting involved in politics for the first time or you're diving in more than you ever have before.
Well, we want to know what got you off the sidelines and what do you hope to accomplish? We know that you love your particular candidate, but we don't want to hear about them. We want to hear about you. So let your voice be heard. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Well, the campaign is continuing to hum this weekend, candidates doing everything they can to stand out from the pack. We brought you an example of that this summer when reporter John Moe profiled one of the most unusual presidential campaign ads ever. It was a YouTube video featuring Democratic candidate Mike Gravel staring at the camera for an uncomfortably long time, throwing a big rock into a lake and then ambling into the distance. John asked Mike Gravel how that spot came to be.
My Southern California coordinator, who's an actress, she contacted me and said there's a couple of young guys that want to videotape you so that they could put it into iTube or wherever. And I said, well, what is it about? She says, well, they want you to throw a rock in the water. Immediately it hit me, the ripple effect. And I view a lot of things I do as causing ripples in society and the body politic.
Are you available for other video projects from other potential voters?
Oh, yes, of course I have. I've never turned one down.
John Moe is with us now, and John, Gravel's right. He doesn't turn down video ideas.
He's true to his word, Bill. He apparently has not been turning down much work when it comes to doing videos. The campaign itself hasn't really caught fire, but he has been making videos aplenty of all stripes, any genre under the sun you can imagine. The one that's been getting the most attention, though, is this sort of mashup of Gravel with John Lennon. It's Gravel's version of the song Give Peace a Chance.
Yeah. Everybody talking about politicians, nepotism, patriotism, jingoism, phony patriotism is jingoism. Why won't you let me say what I want to say? Power to the people. Give peace a chance.
And visually, Bill, you have to imagine sort of a Schoolhouse Rock kind of graphic effect here. A lot of kind of flashing colors, 1776 fife and drum kind of thing going on. And then a long section where a cartoon turtle gets blown up with some dynamite.
Right. No naked Yoko, however.
Naked Yoko on this. Yeah. Just an exploded turtle.
And how did this video happen, John?
Well, once again, somebody came up to the Gravel campaign after an event and said, I've got this idea. Can I borrow Senator Mike Gravel for 15 minutes? And they had him go off and tape this thing where he read these lyrics. And, you know, there's a part where he puts some tape over his mouth and he holds a flag. And then this guy ran off and did it. And apparently it's been a big hit both within the campaign and on YouTube, or as Gravel says, iTube.
The iTube. Compared to the mournful, unsettling Rock in the Water video, this is a more fun Mike Gravel.
That's a sliding scale. It is more
enough.
Fun than he was before. It's still not much fun, but he does smirk once in a while. He does return, however, to the form of the angry man a little bit in another video called The Two Mikes. It's made by a fellow named David Hogue in California, and they wanted to make something that captured Gravel's anger and also was extraordinarily affordable to produce. So they came up with this idea of two Mike Gravel heads kind of floating in space, arguing with each other.
You're running for president? Well, you've been out of politics for 25 years. Well, you could say I'm well-rested. Don't do it. Everybody's going to say you can't win, and even a lot of Democrats don't like you. When I get done, they're going to like me even less. But the country needs a guy like me. Candidates today can't tell you their favorite ice cream without a focus group.
It would have been so much easier to hire a friend to ask the questions, but he did it the hard way.
And we never do find out what his favorite ice cream flavor is.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this one, too, has been all over the internet. People have been watching it. There's more of them out there where Gravel's dressed as Santa at some sort of Tennessee Christmas party. There's one where he's on an elevator talking about an Xbox. Very few of them have anything to do with, like, policy issues about, you know, running for president, for instance.
How has all this iTube love he's been getting actually affected his candidacy?
No discernible effect whatsoever. He's still way at the bottom of the polls, if he even registers on the polls at all. Several of these debates, they haven't even invited Gravel to attend. In fact, at one of them, he wasn't invited, so he had his own event nearby where the debate was being shown on a big screen, and then Gravel would just talk back to the other candidates in front of a group of supporters. So as a candidate, he's been a very successful avant-garde video star.
Weekend America's John Moe. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Bill.
This weekend, Senator Gravel is crisscrossing New Hampshire in an RV campaigning. Don't you want to see those Gravel videos now? Well, you can. You'll find a link to both of them at weekendamerica.org. You got Mike Gravel, Give Him a Chance, and Two Mikes, also known as Floating Heads. So come spend some time with us, peruse our presidential campaign coverage and more at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
How do you mend a broken heart? Nail a note to a lamppost. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Well, we all make New Year's resolutions. And last year, the government polled Americans about their resolutions. And out of the top 10, most were about health or money. Now, helping others more did make the list, but I was really surprised that finding new love didn't.
Yeah, either we've learned that loving ourselves is the greatest love of all, or perhaps we just love the one we're with. I don't know.
Well, at least we have a year to figure it out. Well, yeah. This weekend, we're revisiting a love story we aired just before Valentine's Day. Week in America's Chrissy Clark told us about someone who found a unique way to mend a broken heart.
The signs started showing up in Los Angeles about a month ago. I saw the first one on my way to the video rental place. It was stapled to a telephone pole. Then I spotted one taped to a stop sign in front of a beer garden. So I started keeping an eye out. I asked strangers if they'd seen them too.
I think there's one on that pole right there. It's right below the garage sale sign.
This one's on Sunset Boulevard across from a gelato place and catty corner to a laundromat. At first glance, it looks like a homemade sign for a lost cat. But then you start to read it.
Aww
is a pretty common reaction from the people who happen to notice it. I stood by the sign for 20 minutes. The homeless guy pulling a roller bag doesn't read it. But this couple does.
Smiling. 2-3 days before when we walked together, and my husband, he looked this one and he read it. We smiled together.
I think it's very cute. Maybe they're trying to pick somebody up.
Here's what the sign says in big black letters at the top.
It says, "Lost. I lost my heart somewhere between downtown LA and Venice. It might be broken."
There's a big hand sketch of a heart, and it says, "If found, please email.
Findmyheart@gmail.com. I really need it back."
Cute, right? But who's really going to respond to this thing?
I'll probably forget the email address by the time that I get home.
I have not seen a heart anywhere between downtown LA and Venice.
I think friends are a better shoulder to cry on than random strangers that might see your sign, and I think that's the best possible scenario of the people that would call. It'd probably be a little creepier.
"Dear findmyheart@gmail.com, I saw your poster on the corner of Whitley and Yucca in Hollywood, the same corner where I lost my heart a few years ago, and I decided to help you find yours."
That's waltersgrip@gmail.com. We'll get to him in a second. But first, let me explain. After I saw the poster, I had to email too. You know, in the name of investigative journalism. A very cryptic response came back. Impossible to tell if it was a guy or a girl, and how or if the heart in question was really lost. But a lot of responses. 30 so far. One from a, quote, 21-year-old redhead from New Jersey. She sent a picture of her broken heart tattoo. One from someone named T, who said,
"Basically, life is a bitch. You have to be careful of who you let into your circle of trust."
And here's that guy I just mentioned, waltersgrip@gmail.com, a.k.a. Justin Walters. I met him at a sidewalk cafe in Hollywood. He's 29 and single, in sales. Justin says he spent more than an hour composing his email to the lost heart person.
Part of what got me with the poster was it was about 100 feet from where I really hurt somebody badly and didn't mean to. An ex-girlfriend told me she loved me and I didn't answer. That's kind of what the poster brought back to me, and I just wanted them to know that they weren't by themselves, and if they were by themselves, there was somebody they could call.
This is my place. Polly, it's my dog.
Kate Bonsi is a graphic designer originally from New Hampshire. She saw one of the Lost Heart posters on a walk through her neighborhood.
I saw it, and I glanced at it, I read it, I went, and I walked away, and I turned around and came back.
Why?
It spoke to me. It seemed like it was almost like a message from my past life. In 2001, the period right after my mother died in April, I felt so lost. It was really hard for me to get up every morning and put one foot in front of the other and get in the car and drive to work. And when I would come home, go to the liquor store, buy a pack of cigarettes and one beer, and I would drink a half a beer and put the other half in the refrigerator and go online with my grief group. And I feel like somewhere along the way, I lost my sense of self.
Kate says she imagines the person behind the poster is a guy, a 20-something musician who fell in love with a woman who slipped away. She feels funny connecting to someone she's never met, but she emailed him, and she prays for him.
Oh, sweetie, I know it's like you're suffering now because your heart needs to open up.
One more thing, since it is only 4 days till Valentine's Day. 2 months ago, at age 47, after years of solitary grieving and nights of half beers, Kate says she found her heart at a Christmas party. He's a musician from Montreal, and she says he's not afraid of all her baggage.
I always think that people get kind of scared when you need them. I've seen that a lot in my life. People just back away, like, this is too intimate. I guess I kind of understand it, because it can be painful. Do you know who Amy Mann is?
Yeah, I love Amy.
You know that song Save Me?
Uh-huh.
That came up in my shuffle, and I was just like, wow, this is it. This is our song, because like the whole thing about save me from the ranks of the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone. And I just like, oh my God.
And this is a little cheesy, but you know, tis the season. So fade up the music.
You look like...
Kate quit her job this week, and she's moving to Montreal in a few to be with her heart and get married. In Los Angeles, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
To read the letters and see pictures of the authors, go to our website at weekendamerica.org. As it turns out, Kate did not end up moving to Montreal. Things didn't work out with that guy she met at the Christmas party. Romance didn't save her, but it sounds to me like she saved herself. She wrote us that she's now living near her family in Maine, where the air is fresh and you can see the stars at night. And she says she feels lucky not to have to battle traffic, and it's a good place to grow old.
And as for the person who put up the Lonely Heart poster, we never did find that person. We did learn that he or she is an artist who compiled the public's responses to the poster in an art exhibit called The Other Cheek. It was in Los Angeles this summer. It was a show devoted to people dealing with unresolved resentments and regrets. So you had the original Lost Heart poster there on display, along with dozens of responses from the public. One person's note said, "Did you give it to someone or was it stolen? Are you certain it's even lost? Have you checked on your sleeve? Could you describe the heart, warm or cold, hard or soft? Has it been broken before? Are there any scars to watch out for? Odds are it's just out on the prowl, and it'll come back when it's hungry. Maybe while you're looking for yours, you'll find someone else's too."
Well, you can find out more about that art show. It's called The Other Cheek. Just rest your head on our shoulder. And by that I mean, come to the website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
True or false? Watching nature on TV is better than actually being in nature. Think you know the answer? Well, stay tuned to Weekend America. Thank you. It's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This show is about capturing the spirit of your weekend, and all this year we've been doing that by answering the question, what is your weekend soundtrack? When your mind has time to travel, what music takes you there? A listener named Vedana Vaidyanathan hears our show in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and WUNC, and when we met her this summer, she told us her weekend soundtrack is the Indigo Girls song, Southland in the Springtime. Vedana, why is Southland in the Springtime your weekend soundtrack?
Well, I just moved up here to Chapel Hill last fall for graduate school, and this song always reminds me of my sister. And earlier, March or so, when it became spring, I was listening to the song a great deal because I was really missing her.
What are your memories of your sister and this song?
Driving across I-10 with her, listening to this song. When I was 15, we were on our way to my cousin's wedding in Houston, and it was, she taught me how to steer a car and chastised me because I wasn't doing it very well, while she put her hair up. And we drove over those bridges, over by, going across the bayous, heading toward New Orleans.
That's appropriate. This song is about a road trip, right?
Yes, heading
back from New Orleans.
Yeah. God made me born a Yankee, he was teasing. There's no place like home, and none more pleasing than the Southland in the springtime.
So how much do you love the Southland in the springtime?
Oh, I think it's absolutely gorgeous to be down here in the spring. I love kayaking and hiking and canoeing and... You know, it's just amazing the way the weather changes, the way the flowers come out, the fact that I can walk outside right now and hear the birds singing, and as soon as dusk comes, I'll be hearing a million bullfrogs behind me.
When do you find yourself wanting to put this song on?
When I'm really feeling like I'm feeling alone. It just makes me feel safe to listen to the song.
Safe, huh? Why is that?
Because it reminds me of my family. It reminds me of the road trips. It reminds me of the of just spending time with my sister and spending time with my family, and it's very important to me. And the smoke from the chimneys meets its maker in the sky with a song that winter wrote whose melody.
Does your sister know you still listen to that road trip song?
I don't think she does. I don't know if she knows just what memories the song brings to me.
Are the Indigo Girls still cool?
Well, I'm in graduate school for library science, so I don't particularly consider myself cool, so I have no idea. There's no place like home, none more pleasing than the South.
Vedana, thank you so much for sharing your weekend soundtrack with us.
You're very welcome.
Vedana's weekend soundtrack was Southland in the Springtime by the Indigo Girls. So what about you? Tell us the soundtrack to your weekend. We don't care how cool it is. And tell us why, okay, at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and I'm glad you're listening to our show right now because we have got some stiff competition on television today, specifically the instantly classic nature series Blue Planet with David Attenborough.
Our planet is a blue planet. Over 70% of it is covered by the sea.
Attenborough is the father of this kind of show. His BBC nature programs are hugely popular with the cult of nature documentary lovers here in the States. And those nature doc watchers are such a fascinating species themselves that Weekend America's Sean Cole wondered what it would sound like if David Attenborough did a program about them.
Fans of nature documentaries tend to nest in an urban setting, like this one, Brookline, Massachusetts.
That is not Sean's real voice, by the way.
Thanks for blowing it. This is Ariel Glassman's habitat. She's 25, lives with her boyfriend.
Thank you very much.
And when you see their apartment...
It's Brookline, it's small, but...
It's tiny. So you can understand why she has 75 nature documentaries in her Netflix queue.
Life in the Undergrowth, National Geographic Africa, The Life of Birds, Blue Planet.
Three of those are by David Attenborough. And his latest program, Planet Earth, was running Sundays at 8 o'clock on TV, the same time as the PBS show Nature.
So my nature shows are competing with each other.
Except there's already a Planet Earth DVD.
That my boyfriend and I managed to get a Canadian copy of before the series even premiered here.
Oh my God, you had a bootleg copy.
I had a bootleg copy.
And why?
I have lived in cities or fairly dense suburban areas my whole life, and there's only so much access you get to the natural world in those places. And I think it's fantastic for me to be able to take a look at places I've never been, probably never see with my own eyes.
Why do you say you may never get to go there?
Because I can't afford to go there.
Actually, Ariel spent a lot of her childhood in Amherst, Mass. There are no tigers there, but it's really leafy and green, and she had a lot more time to frolic in the grass back then. She told me about this one time. She was with a friend, and they stumbled across a kind of hidden canyon in the woods. And, you know, for a little kid, that's like happening upon a Mayan ruin.
It taught me how striking the natural world could be, how it could just take you by surprise. It was sort of the gateway moment.
A gateway to watching nature shows on TV.
If I hadn't had those experiences, I'm not sure I'd be as interested today in, you know, what I can see on the television.
And yes, Ariel knows that sounds backwards, but it's like that moment burned a permanent question mark into her brain. And the nature shows are these little exclamation points. For example, watching Life of Mammals by David Attenborough, she felt like she wasn't so superior to other beings with hair.
It's kind of grounding because we are still in reality mammals, just like that squirrel on my tree out there.
When a squirrel finds a white acorn, it always eats it immediately, because otherwise it would soon germinate.
Ariel and I sat down to watch Life of Mammals at one point.
On the other hand, red acorns, like this one, are almost always buried as a store for winter.
And then, weeks later, when I mentioned to a completely different person that I'd seen the show, she said,
"Did you see the part about the acorns?
Yeah.
Where they knew what to do with the two different kinds of acorns?
Yeah,
yeah, that, I saw that one.
Really?
Yeah, it's
that was
fascinating.
Amazing.
This is
it's
Melissa Guillaume. She once drew a picture of four ducks playing volleyball and one of a rhino having cocktails with a warthog. Right? She's an illustrator and a really big David Attenborough fan.
Tricky. I almost have a little bit of a crush on him, you know what I mean?
Her husband, who's also named David, knows this.
I mean, if I have to lose her to somebody, you know, I respect Attenborough.
For a Manhattan apartment, their place is pretty big, though it got a little smaller last year when their daughter Holly was born.
You know, we got a 9-month-old, and I would love to go to New Zealand tomorrow, but it's not going to happen.
So David Attenborough does most of their traveling for them.
I'm on Lord Howe Island, a tiny speck of land 300 miles off the east coast of Australia.
You know, I feel like the human being has a certain, like, range of things they have to get. It's like you have to have interactions with people, and you have to sleep, and you have to play, and you have to interact with plants and animals. I don't know. I really think it's like it has to happen.
And that's the way you do it.
And I guess that's the way that we're doing it right now.
And sometimes, as though they'd just gotten back from an actual vacation, they find themselves telling their friends about the exotic places they've seen.
You know, well, then you should have seen, because then the, you know, the polar bear came out of hibernation.
It's funny, I never really thought about it, but recently I've started to think that maybe we're getting a reputation among our friends for watching kind of a weird amount of this stuff.
It's true. One of their friends told me that they could discuss this IMAX movie about beavers, quote, at great length.
One night under a full moon, Mr. Beaver male beaver comes over and starts kind of chattering amorously to the female beaver, and they sort of do this moonlight pas de deux where they actually rear up on their hind legs and embrace each other with their little claws and go tottering back and forth in the moonlight. And the camera sort of considerately pans right, sort of away from the little beavers or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, cut to baby beavers in Beaver Lodge.
So they didn't actually show the full-on beaver stripping?
No, 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 no. It wasn't that kind of movie.
Of course, beavers aren't exactly travel-to-Africa animals.
I guess there are beavers probably within 10 miles of where we're sitting.
Donal O'Shea lives in San Jose now, but he grew up in Ireland, watching David Attenborough on the BBC. And unlike a lot of nature show fans, he's been all over the world. Been to South Africa a bunch of times.
And I've had the opportunity to go up to the game parks, and I've only gone once, so it's much more comfortable to sit in your living room and watch it on TV than to actually run the risk of catching malaria and all the rest of it.
I can huff and puff to the top of the mountain.
This is Ariel again.
But David Attenborough's not going to follow me all the way up in a helicopter, giving me all the details about, you know, the antelope that's 20 yards to my left that I can't even see.
And this is the very simple but very important idea that kept rearing up as I talked to these folks. On TV, the animals are so close, and they're doing such interesting things. And in person, they'd be too skittish or bloodthirsty or just plain boring to sit and be awed by. But there's something even more basic that nature shows offer, something more gut level than the awe factor. And that is the awe factor.
There is definitely a cute factor. On planet Earth, there's this footage of a mother polar bear and her little babies, just as they're coming out of the hibernating den.
Her cubs gaze out at their bright new world for the very first time.
They can barely walk. They've never eaten anything other than their mother's milk.
The female calls them. But this steep slope is not the easiest place to take your first steps.
And it's just, you know, all of a sudden one of them just tumbles, you know, and it's so cute.
Which, you know, cuddling up to a polar bear would be not something that would be recommended, but to watch them is a warming feeling.
And then when the narrator says,
but they are hungry.
Unfortunately, you know, reality is cruel and the mother and the bear cubs will have to find food within a week now or they're going to starve. That's when I always start to kind of go, you know, and then when they show them tracking down the baby, like, seal pup, and you know they're going to eat it, you know? You have that moment where you're like... And actually, Dave and I have this expression. We'll say, end of seal pup, continuation of polar bear, you know? Because we have to remind ourselves that there's a good side of that story, you know?
Have you ever gotten emotional watching a nature program?
Oh, of course. Yeah, horribly. Yeah. Actually, especially after the birth of our child, I would say it's actually gotten worse.
It's funny. I remember shortly after Holly was born, there was some kind of nature show on, and I remember seeing this bird hatch out of the egg, and the parents sort of nuzzling it. And yeah, as a parent of a, you know, whatever she was, 4 weeks old or something at that time, yeah, Melissa and I just looked at each other, and we both had tears in our eyes, and. You can't help but relate to the helplessness of a baby when you're a parent, you know.
Whether it's on TV or not.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And whether it's human or not.
There's a certain kind of religious component to it, almost. You know, you're getting a view of the world, of life, of existence that is outside you and your normal experience. I mean, I'm getting a bit carried away about the whole thing now, but it just kind of forces you to recognize that by no means are you and the people around you and the human race the only things to be considered or thought about or worried about.
And if this were a David Attenborough documentary, that's probably how it would end.
We can ensure that there is still a place on Earth for birds in all their beauty and variety, if we want to. And surely we should.
You know, we talked to Ariel again since we first aired that beautiful story in September. She has moved from Massachusetts to Seattle. She says she feels much closer to nature now. She's got lakes and mountains and more urban green space. But instead of satisfying her thirst, it's only made her more curious about the natural world. She told us her Netflix queue is as long as ever, and she is still, quote, a nature special addict.
Well, this piece we just heard is part of a public radio series. It's called Stories from the Heart of the Land. They're produced by Jay Allison and Emily Botine. You'll find a link to the series. Just go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
And since we have whetted your appetite for Attenborough, you can see some of his YouTube greatest hits, including A Journey to the Bottom of the Deep Sea to an Alien World Never Revealed Before. We have created a stunning environment for you at our website. Links, videos, essays, music, underwater volcanoes at weekendamerica.org. So here's a question. If watching nature docs on TV is not your idea of a perfect way to spend a winter weekend, then what is? We're gathering stories and suggestions for the ideal way to spend a winter Saturday and Sunday.
Well, you know, I had a neighbor, Maury, and he had this theory. He said that in the winter, we're supposed to do what the bears do, put on weight and sleep. And I've always loved that theory. Oh. You know, so I checked it out with the University of Minnesota researcher. His name is Erhard House. And he told me that we're not really built to hibernate like bears, but we do have a winter cycle. With the darkness stretching out longer in the wintertime, we increase more melatonin in our bodies, and that can lower fertility. And the lack of light also depresses mood. But none of that explains why I want to spend all of my winter weekends eating cookies and reading.
Human hibernation. Well, we want to know how you best spend your winter cycle, whether you are in Nome or in Miami. What is your perfect winter weekend? Doing puzzles or making sandcastles, hibernating or hightailing it? Winter comes just once a year, so tell us how you spend it, will you? We're waiting to hear from you at weekendamerica.org.
If you've got a favorite song, don't tell anybody. It could scar you for life. Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, Happy New Year. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke.
The one song that I remember from my childhood.
The first song that I remember.
My dad used to sing it.
The most important song.
I just love to play over and over and over.
This year in our Song and Memory series, we've been asking you what song still stays with you from your childhood. And one of our favorite stories came from Mike Daisy. Mike's an actor in New York, and one thing that he remembers about being a kid is all the conversations he would get into with adults, conversations that always seem to go one way.
When you're little, I think, people define kids by questions. They ask them, you know, what's your favorite color? And they have to have an answer. And I remember that I felt like I should have a song that was my favorite song because it seemed like other people were doing that. And so there was some degree of peer pressure. I have to have a favorite song.
Yeah, there's just one problem, though. What if you figure out your answer and it's wrong?
On some level, I'm still embarrassed that my favorite song at the second grade was Private Eyes by Hall & Oates. And in fact, I feel vulnerable about that. I at one point declared it to be my favorite song, which is weird because I think I probably should cut myself some slack. But in my head, there's no slack cut at all. Instead, I'm like, that was a bad choice. I must have had a better choice. But I don't know what that choice would have been. I don't know when Hall & Oates' Private Eyes came out because I was very, very young. And I don't remember hearing it the first or second or third time, but I think I remember hearing it like the 10th, 15th, and 20th times because it became one of those songs. I think I heard it when we drive around in our car. I see you, and you see me. And I would sit in the back seat with my window rolled down because my parents would smoke. And I remember sitting there like trying to breathe the fresh oxygen out the window and listening to this Hall & Oates song as we drove past the endless potato fields of Maine. When it's watching for lies. I remember that I thought the song was creepy and that I liked it. Like, I like the idea that private eyes are watching you. And that they're watching your every move. I would really enjoy watching you, watching you, watching you. I was a very fat, strange child. Like, I was very geeky and weird, and I would stand at the edge of the playground rocking in a sort of autistic fashion during recess. Like, I wouldn't play with other children very much. And if other kids did come try to talk to me, I would get very excited because actually I really wanted to talk, but I didn't know what to say. And so I would end up talking about black holes, which I was very obsessed with at the time. And I would try to explain to them all about black holes and singularities and collapsing stars. I would get really excited. And so I didn't talk to other kids very much. I remember one day in the cafeteria, I was eating my lunch alone. And some other more normal children came over and sat near me and began talking to me. And I remember I was very alarmed because they were sort of talking to me like they actually wanted to talk to me. And they asked me, hey, what's your favorite song? I knew that there were probably correct responses. Like, there were songs I think that everybody else would all say the same song. But I didn't know what it was because I hadn't been talking to anyone because I sit alone all the time thinking about black holes. So I did a terrible thing. I told the truth, and I said, Private Eyes. And everyone sitting around me began to laugh. And I was horrified, and I remember I left the lunchroom and went to the classroom and just sat in the classroom waiting for everyone else to come back from lunch and hoping it was over. And then when everyone came in, everyone in the class had been told about my terrible song choice. And everyone roundly laughed at me. It's funny about this memory because it feels like it's ripped from any number of sort of teen and child comedies, like the scene in which our hero is scarred for life. And every time I remember this, it doesn't seem real.
My life is over.
This had a profound effect because what I decided was that I would never have a favorite song and that instead I would hate all music forever. And in fact, I really internalized it and I actually hated all music for like years and years and years. Music was on the radio. I was like, turn it off. Music is barbaric and it's just intended to chain us to our emotions. If we're going to have an emotion, we should just have it on our own. I don't need any stinking music to tell me what my emotions are going to be. Thank you. And I remember explaining this to my father in these cold, measured tones. My father looking at me like, oh my God. The look on his face, like looking at me like, I gave birth to an alien. This is my alien son. But I was very adamant about it. After this thing happened, I thought about the song all the time because I was always like, why did I say that song? Should never have chosen that song.
Why that song?
If I'd said any other song, they wouldn't have laughed at me and then, you know, things would be better. Very often when I play the song, I literally go back to that day and like, I'm sitting in the lunchroom. And then the people come over, and I have to remember all the steps of it, and that's kind of a drag. Private eyes, they're watching you. you don't want to recollect on your entire life when you're listening to this Hall & Oates song. You know, you kind of just want to hear it because it's a nice song. Watching you, watching you, watching you. They're private eyes. They're watching you.
You can find links to more of Mike Daisy's memories. Just go to our website at weekinamerica.org.
I remember that pain, man, of not knowing what was cool and what wasn't. I once said Obladi Oblada was a stupid song, and I was ostracized for blaspheming the Fab Four. Sad.
Well, you know, we always have to figure out at some point what our opinion is and then learn to stand beside it. And I learned that lesson much later in life. I was a Madonna fan from the start. I wasn't ashamed of that. Until I decided to go to one of her concerts in 1990, I was 30 and pregnant, very pregnant. And everybody in the place was like 16 and wearing their lingerie on the outside of their clothes. I was so humiliated. But I stayed at that concert. So come on, y'all, express yourself. Share your own song and memory with us. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
That's it for this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Thank you for spending the year 2007 with us. And if you haven't tried it, check out our free podcast. Download our program at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, Weekend Americans, have a happy new year.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm ready to bust a move. I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend. America.